Sometimes legal and other rights turn full circle over surprisingly few years. While there's now a big push for greater recognition and support for trans people, for example, up until the 1960s in the UK, things were actually a bit better in some ways. If you were trans, trans people then typically self-identified. They received affirmative medical care, took a doctor's letter to the General Register Office and corrected the sex on their birth certificate, and lived equally. So says Zoe Playton, who has spent some years investigating the life and significance of Ewan Forbes, a Scottish doctor who was born as Elizabeth in 1912, but from a very early age, with his mother's support, was able to live as male. He would later have to prove his maleness when he was contesting an inheritance, and that legal case is significant, but until now, the public hasn't really known about it. Zoe Playton is Emeritus Professor of Medical Humanities at the University of London, and she's the former co-chair of the Gay and Lesbian Association of Doctors and Dentists, which is enchantingly known as GLAD. And she co-founded the UK's Parliamentary Forum on Gender Identity in 1944. Her book, The Hidden Case of Ewan Forbes, is getting quite a bit of attention. So, Zoe, although the book is new, there are already plans for a TV drama.
Yes, that's right. Jules Hussey at Brazen Productions has taken up the option. They're doing a treatment, and eventually I guess we'll move to casting and then broadcast. It's, a three-part TV miniseries.
Well, congratulations. That's an excellent response to your work.
Thank you.
And you've been wanting to look at the Ewan Forbes story for quite a while.
Yes, I first came across the case in 1996 when I was tipped off about it. I was told about a secret case that had been removed from the public eye. Everyone involved in it had been sworn to secrecy because I was told there are some things that it's more important to protect than the rights of individuals. I took 2 years and the direct intervention of the Home Secretary to uncover the case. But then, because of the day job and also the other activist work, I didn't get an opportunity to look at it until I retired from my NHS post in 2016. So then I had a look at Ewan's case and was really very shocked by what I found and by its implications, not just for the UK, but actually internationally, including Australia.
Zoe, let's go to 1970 and the story of April Ashley.
What happens is that on the same day that Ewan Forbes is going into court for his case to be heard, Arthur Corbett, the son and heir of Lord Rowallan, files divorce papers for his marriage, or his ceremony of marriage to April. What happened? April, in fact, hadn't corrected her birth certificate, as Ewan had, and so the marriage was just void, and the whole thing could just have been pushed away as other such marriages were, as being void right from the start. But instead, the case was used as a sort of a show trial to cure the problem that Ewan caused. Ewan was a trans man who inherited a primogeniture baronetcy. Primogeniture is this archaic English law, still exists, that says that certain titles and estates can only be inherited by a man, never by a woman. And as a trans man, by inheriting a primogeniture baronetcy, Ewan caused a UK constitutional crisis, because at that point, the Crown was subject to primogeniture. If a trans man can get a baronetcy, a trans man can be king. Constitutional law is all about securing succession to the throne for political stability. Ewan had wrecked that.
So now, you became aware of this because of April Ashley's solicitor alerted you to it.
That's right. It was Terence Walton, April's solicitor, who told me of this hidden case, Ewan's case, that had been taken out of the public eye. So that people were left thinking that April's case, Corbett versus Corbett, was the definitive case, that there wasn't a precedent before it. But of course, it was Ewan's case, and April wasn't allowed to use that in court, which is, you know, a breach of fundamental democracy and legal procedure. And instead, the judge used April to create a legal argument, not a medical one or a scientific one, a legal argument to declare that trans people were mentally ill, and that April herself wasn't and never could be a female, but was instead a homosexual transvestite. And the shocking thing is that this decision became an international super precedent that was cited in the US, in Canada, in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, continental Europe.
How extraordinary. And of course, he won the case. The marriage was annulled, wasn't it?
Well, Arthur Corbett won the case. There was no case to win. There had never been a marriage in the first place because April hadn't corrected her birth certificate. And one of the bizarre things is that the same judge who heard April's case had just a few weeks before heard another similar case and dismissed it out of hand. Instead, this time there was a 14-day show trial, and with all of these consequences. In fact, it wasn't until 2001 that an Australian judge, Judge Chisholm, in the case of Ree Kevin, revealed or showed how Ormerod's argument was fatally flawed, that it was, well, broadly nonsense. It was a circular argument. And it was Australia that led the way in releasing trans people into some measure, at least, of equality by dismissing Ormerod's
I understand that you had to, first of all, figure out who the mystery person was at the centre of the mystery legal case.
That's right. We were just told there was such a case. I got in touch with trans colleagues who are community leaders, and we decided it had to be a trans man, that it had to be something to do with primogeniture because of these interests more important than those of individuals. They remembered Ewan Forbes and faxed me through his obituary. And on the face of it, it looked as though he was intersexed, and it would be easy to find the case and dismiss it. But when I went to the law library, it wasn't there. It wasn't in the National Scots Law Library or in their National Records Office. No one could find it anywhere. And when we wrote to the Home Office and the Lord Advocate, we got a very dusty answer back saying that they knew about the case but wouldn't let us see anything, any documents. In fact, it was my old history teacher from school who found a newspaper clipping that led me to identify the case as being Ewan Forbes.
I'm talking to Zoe Playden. On the face of it, you point out that Ewan was, quote, intersex, born with a variation of internal and or external genitalia, but this wasn't thought of as transsexual.
Yes, it was. Until the 1960s, being trans was regarded and classified as an intersex condition, a variation of sex development, and treated as such. Unfortunately, in 1960s America, the same people who were busy trying to cure gay men and lesbians turned their attention to trans people, and a bunch of psychiatrists, particularly John Money and Richard Green, spent an awful lot of time reclassifying trans people as mentally ill. First of all, doing that in the States, and then exporting it over here in 1969. So we've now gone back to the idea at last that being trans isn't a mental illness, and therefore it can only be a somatic condition. There's nothing else for it to be but a natural variation of sex development.
So it is now time to introduce us to the child Elizabeth and the family that this child was born into.
So the Forbes Semple family, a Scots aristocratic family, they were not a grand family, they weren't dukes or marquesses, but they were very distinguished. Ewan's grandfather was an intimate friend of Queen Victoria, his mother was a close friend of Queen Mary, and his father was aide-de-camp to the king. They had a huge estate, 20,000 acres. At one end of it was the lovely Craigavar Castle, which is now part of the National Trust for Scotland. At the other end was Fintry Manor, which is now gone after being used as a hospital in World War II. Remarkably, Ewan's mother noticed, as I mean, the parent of any trans kid will tell you this, they noticed that their kid, no matter what it said on their birth certificate, that their kid was, in Ewan's case, male. And fortunately, in the late 1920s, Ewan was born in 1912. In the late 1920s, synthetic hormones were being produced, and Ewan's mother took him when he was an adolescent on an international tour to get synthetic testosterone.
Zoe, do you mind if we walk this back a bit before we
sure.
look at that part of the story? I think it's important to know about the family. The couple had four children. There's William, who became, well, an engineer, an aviator, and a spy for the Japanese.
Probably not a spy, no. It's just one of those unfortunate urban myths that he was a spy. He was certainly an aviator. He was certainly the person who went on a mission to Japan for the British government to help the Japanese, who were our allies, to create their air force. But there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that he was in any shape or form a spy.
Then there's Gwendolyn, who dies of appendicitis before Ewan's birth. Margaret,
that's right,
a decorated member of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force in the Second World War. Once again, an achiever.
Yeah, no, very much so. Older than Ewan, and within the family, known for having a very sharp temper. Everyone had to appease Margaret all the time. She was herself a lesbian whose life partner, Joan, was also her business partner in raising horses. She was a horse breeder. And indeed, some of her horses
well,
were used.
We're going
to
come back to Margaret, aren't we, later
yep.
in the story, because she plays a major role in the court case. Now, Ewan's mother is obviously a very progressive woman, and she, as you say, she's trying very hard to help the child.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she was remarkable. They were internationally connected as a family, and Ewan's mother, Gwendolyn, the Lady Semple, was connected with just about everyone that you could be connected with, not just aristocracy and royalty, but also the international avant-garde, people like, you know, the poet Ezra Pound, for example, as well as having a cousin in Austria who was head of MI6. So she was hugely well connected. And of course, at the time, there was a lot of interest in early endocrinology. Magnus Hirschfeld had opened his clinic in Berlin in 1910. And so she will have known amongst the, you know, her class, there will have been that discussion about the new ideas about sex and sexology. And she was very supportive. Having said all of that, you know, she could only protect Ewan so far. And Ewan's father was a stickler for duty and for doing things the way they were supposed to be done. And so from time to time, although Ewan was allowed to live and dress and be as he was, from time to time, if he had to appear in public, his father insisted that he dressed up as a girl. Which, of course, must have been appalling and traumatic for him.
And yet, there was a degree of acceptance of this unusual young person in the north of Scotland, even a bit of a local star.
Oh, well, you know, there was, because people could see that he was having a difficult time, and he stayed in his locality all of his life. He was a doctor to local people. There are many people in at that end of Aberdeenshire who still remember Ewan as their doctor, and they remember him with fondness. He was, you know, a kind, gentle person who just wanted to get on with his life.
Well, there's descriptions of the busy life of a rural doctor, and he was also called upon to act as a medical officer for a large number of German POWs.
He was, yes. It took quite a while for prisoners of war to be repatriated at the end of World War II, and there were big camps up in Aberdeenshire. Ewan, because he could speak both French and German, was particularly valuable. It meant that he could speak to the prisoners in their own language, which is really helpful for diagnosis and treatment. That was part of his work. He was a very dedicated man, very dedicated to his community, very dedicated to the professional roles that he took.
And dedicated to the truth, hence a rather matter-of-fact notice he puts in the local paper in 1952.
Yes, in 1952, Ewan has fallen in love and wants to marry. To do that, he's got to correct his birth certificate, and just to say, this wasn't really a problem at the time. A little bit more complicated in Scotland than England, but certainly not a problem. So Ewan corrects his birth certificate and simply puts on the back page of the local paper a tiny little advert saying that from now on he'll be known as Ewan. And
he's 40 years old, isn't he, at this point?
He is, yes. It causes a bit of a furore in the press, really because of the title and because, of course, they are a prominent family in the area. And people begin to say, so does this mean that he will inherit the baronetcy or what? Well, obviously, it should have meant that he inherited the baronetcy.
Okay, we'll get onto that in just a second. But his, you know, his plans were known in advance to many of his patients, and they were supportive, weren't they, because he was so popular?
Oh, very supportive. A lot of his patients were hill farmers in remote crofts in Scotland, and Ewan would get to them if they needed him. He would get to them by skis or snowshoes or on horseback. He had the reputation that no matter how high the river, how deep the snow, the doctor would get to his patient. And when he married, they organised a collection and had a huge presentation for him at the local village hall to show their respect and admiration.
Now, there's quite a bit of interest when he decides to marry his housekeeper, Isabella, mm-hmm. and I understand Fleet Street arrives in some force.
It did arrive in some force. It was a love match, not an aristocratic match. Patty was the daughter of a hill farmer, but the press turn up and block the road so that Ewan can't get out. Ewan drives over the hills in his Land Rover to escape them. On another occasion, local people, seeing that the press were driving after Ewan, pulled a lorry across the road to stop them. They were very supportive.
Now, let's deal with the court case. It is argued that his 1952 birth re-registration was invalid, and his cousin John says this to claim the right to the title and to, well, the inheritance.
That's right. Big shock to everyone. No one had seen cousin John until he turned up at the funeral of Ewan's brother and said to Ewan, I'm going to claim the title because you're not really a man. We never know, any of us, how we'll react when we're faced with that kind of violence. In Ewan's case, he first of all tried to appease John. He said, I'll give you all of the 20,000-acre estate, all of the family's wealth and inheritance, if you just won't challenge me for the title, because you'll get the title when I die anyway. And initially, John agreed to that, but he only agreed to it until he had his hands on the money.
Now, to make the complicate the family drama even more, and we haven't got a huge amount of time left, Margaret takes John's side.
She does. She's in debt. John says he'll pay her debts if she'll write a letter saying that Ewan is definitively female. She does so. Ewan finds out, is absolutely horrified. Eventually, she and Ewan reconcile, and it looks as though all of John's support has gone away until just before the trial, Margaret is killed in a car crash.
The only way for Forbes to bypass this issue of demonstrating or proving his sexuality is he's got to prove he's got physical male traits. And this involves some trickery. Apparently he procures some testes tissue and passes it off as his own.
It does, yes. What Ewan knows as a doctor is that medical classification is changing, that this US, these US psychiatrists, Money and Green, are now keen to claim that trans people are mentally ill, not intersexed. And he also knows that unless he wins, he and Patty will be sent to prison for perjury, because if Ewan is declared female, then he is a lesbian and so is Patty. They have gone through a perjured marriage, and the penalty for that is 2 years in prison, deregistration from the medical register, and their whole life ruined. So his back is absolutely against the wall. The man's done everything he can to get out of this, and now he has no alternative but to fight. And so he does. He uses all the resources at his disposal, and with an astonishing set of incidents, he wins the case.
So much more to tell, but we'll have to wait the televised version. How does Ewan's life end?
The case took 3 years to decide, and it really knocked the stuffing out of him. He was, far more withdrawn, far more anxious, less sociable, had all the symptoms of what we'd now think of as post-traumatic stress disorder, really. But he just lived quietly. He was very devoted to his local church, very devoted to his community and friends and relations. And he just ended his life as he'd always wanted to live it, quietly, unremarkably, and happily.
I understand that he published a book of reminiscences.
He did. When he was 80, he published a little book of memoirs in which he makes no mention of the court case or the circumstances arising from it.
How
he defined himself as a very radical, a radical definition of himself on his own grounds and on his own terms.
And Cousin Refusing John gets the title after all, and what an interesting time for you to be writing a book on this theme.
Yes, well, indeed. As you may know, there have been a series of attempts to try to get rid of primogeniture from the UK. Six different bills in the last 6 years, all of them killed, a seventh one in preparation. This combination of anxiety about trans equality and an attempt to get rid of what is absolutely systemic sex discrimination through primogeniture, they're happening all at the same time.
Zoe, thanks for that. Zoe Playden's book, The Hidden Case of Ewan Forbes, published by Bloomsbury.